In this 1968 recording, the Beatles sang that the Ukraine girls really knocked them out and left the West behind, and that the Moscow girls made them sing and shout. But that didn't endear them to the Soviet government. The Kremlin banned the Beatles, although it couldn't stop the Fab Four from developing an underground following among Soviet youth. Leslie Woodhead, a documentary filmmaker and former Cold War spy, has written How the Beatles Rocked the Kremlin, The Untold Story of a Noisy Revolution. It's published by Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Woodhead back to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Good to be here.
But the Soviet government wasn't alone. Didn't South Africa ban the Beatles for 4 years? And there were 35 radio stations right here in the United States, most of them in Texas, that banned the Beatles.
I'm sure that's true. I think what was special and entirely different in the Soviet Union was that they were so undesired by the Kremlin that the penalties were real. In other words, you could lose your job or your education for possessing a Beatles album. They had special scratching devices at the airport that could destroy any album that made it into customs. I mean, they really, really meant it.
And why were they so concerned?
Well, it's a very, very interesting question. I think that the old guys in the Kremlin weren't stupid. They intuited that there was something about the spirit of this music which was a threat to them. And in fact, they weren't wrong. They understood in their guts that the spirit that it represented, the freedom, the openness, the challenge to authority, really was not good news for them.
And this is something that repressive governments all over the world saw as a threat from the Beatles. I mentioned South Africa. In Greece, if I remember correctly, if you try to enter the country at that time when the Greek colonels were in power and you had a Beatles haircut, they would cut off the hair.
I think you're right. The Beatles often inspired that kind of resistance from authoritarian regimes.
Well, what was Soviet pop music like when the Beatles became a worldwide sensation around 1962 or so?
Pretty bland. I mean, there were a lot of guys with bad wigs and terrible cardigans belting out patriotic ballads. There was a lot of sentimental patriotic music. But there was very little that had the kind of energy that, as one of my informants put it, our bodies craved, and the Beatles came up with that.
Did it sound like Western music, or did it have mostly Russian roots?
It had mostly Russian roots, but remember that
there was also jazz.
There was jazz.
And that was also repressed to a large degree.
It was, and I spent some time in the book talking about the lengthy history of Stalin's repression of all manner of Western music. And the story of jazz and its repression in the former Soviet Union is another whole long story.
So were laws actually passed that said we ban the Beatles?
No, there was nothing formally stated. They didn't go down that route, but everybody understood that it was a bad thing to do. And in fact, places like schools really clamped down on it to try and stop it at source.
So how did Soviet youth manage to listen to Beatles songs?
Well, that's a really interesting story. Since it was formally unavailable, what happened was that the kids tuned into Radio Luxembourg, BBC, Radio Free Europe, and heard the stuff. They then, a few of them had primitive tape recorders, and they went down to booths on the streets in Moscow and St. Petersburg and inscribed the Beatles songs onto the only vinyl available, which incredibly were x-rays of their Uncle Sergei's lungs.
So this is the equivalent of Samizdat.
Exactly.
As in the music.
Yeah. Only on these, I mean, I've actually got one of these at home, one of these things where you can see the ribs and you can play I Feel Fine on the thing.
Was that one of the particularly popular songs?
Yeah.
I Feel Fine. I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Yeah, I want to.
Do people understand the lyrics?
No. And that in itself is fascinating. Of course, the lyrics were unfathomable to most Soviet kids, partly because they were in, you know, fairly dense Liverpool accents. So what they were attending to was the feel of the music, not the verbal content.
I'd assume also that banning the Beatles only made them more popular.
Very much so. I think if the Kremlin had ignored them, they would just have they would have faded. But they didn't ignore them. And, of course, the fact that that it wasn't freely available, made it forbidden fruit and therefore much desired.
And then Beatles tribute bands popped up across the USSR?
Pretty well straight away. In fact, my rock and roll informants over there will say that virtually every single local rock band was derived from and inspired by the Beatles.
And did the government respond?
Those bands were, again, below the official radar.
So this is not like Pussy Riot going to jail for a few years.
But what they did, those bands, first of all, they had to make their own instruments. There weren't any. So they sawed up their grandma's kitchen table to make a guitar body. They discovered from a young Pioneer magazine that you could take the coil out of a telephone handset and turn it into a pickup for an electric guitar. So apparently within a few weeks, all the phones in St. Petersburg and Moscow were all immobilized by rock fans.
Did any of the other top Western stars at the time, Bob Dylan, the Rolling Stones, the Beach Boys, enjoy similar popularity?
But all of them had some profile, but none of them came near the Beatles. And the question of why that was is an intriguing one. The Rolling Stones and Little Richard and acts like that were just too, I suppose, hypersexualized for the Russian taste. They have they adore melody, and you don't get more melodic than a Paul McCartney song. And so that really, really communicated. Somebody said something wonderful to me, a guy in St. Petersburg. He said, to understand how it worked for us, you think of the way a dog or a cat response to us. They don't understand the verbal content, but the feeling they absolutely get, and that's how it was for us.
And you consulted with a Soviet music critic, Art Troitsky?
I did.
Troitsky sounds too close to Trotsky for a man to live.
it's hardly possible to have a man who's more unlike Trotsky than Artemy Troitsky. He's a wonderfully seditious, wonderfully quirky, offbeat guy who's given his life over to the Soviet version of rock and roll and is an endless source of extraordinary stories about that.
He wound up showing you shrines?
He showed me everything. And he told me about his own life, which was shot through with all manner of problems. He actually grew up in... He's from Moscow, but he grew up in Prague. And his father was an interpreter who knew Che Guevara, weirdly. But Art remembers hearing rock and roll in Prague, trying to put it on the school radio and getting chucked out of school. And when he got back to Moscow, he was chucked out of the Young Pioneers. I mean, it was a constant battle with authority.
Could he have been sent to jail?
No. I don't think it would have come to that, but it could have really stifled his educational chances.
Did the Beatles ever get to play as a full group in the Soviet Union?
No, never.
Because there's a myth about a secret concert.
There is, yes, which fascinatingly turns up everywhere I went. The local fans all believe that on their way to Japan, the Beatles plane landed at some airstrip near them and they played a secret concert on the wing of the plane. Of course, every town believes that it was their secret concert. And I even talked to someone who struggled his way under the barbed wire onto an airstrip in Minsk in Belarus and was arrested by a guard and all of that. But no, they were nowhere near being able to play there. And in fact, Ringo played a fairly unnoticed concert in 1998, but the real big moment was Paul in Red Square.
In 2003.
That's correct.
Did he play back in the USSR?
He certainly did, and the place fell apart. I mean, he played back in the USSR. There were tens of thousands of people literally in tears during that.
What kind of demographic in that crowd?
Just 8 to 80, plus Putin, plus Gorbachev, plus all those guys who'd imprisoned, popular music practitioners for decades.
Putin, of course, has put Pussy Riot in prison.
He has indeed.
I'm sure he doesn't see the irony in attending a Paul McCartney concert and putting them in jail.
I don't think he does the irony in a big way. Interestingly, his first deputy, a guy called Sergei Ivanov, I actually talked to for the book and for a film I did. He's a huge Beatles fan, When I asked to see him, I thought, you'll never make time to talk about the Beatles. He said anything for the Beatles. He showed up, and he insisted to me that he learned his beautiful English from studying Beatles lyrics. That's how he taught himself English.
My guest is Leslie Woodhead, who's written a book called How the Beatles Rocked the Kremlin, The Untold Story of a Noisy Revolution. You had been a British spy during the Cold War.
Yeah, I'd been a very, very foot soldier in the espionage wars.
That's before the Beatles came along?
Yes, before the Berlin Wall was built. It's in the late 50s. I was one of 5,000 young men who were taught Russian, in my case by the RAF, to go and listen in on Soviet pilots flying in out of East Berlin. So we were taught, we were taught proper Russian, but then just specialized on listening to that.
So you could not know at the time that you were learning Russian so that later you could write a book about the Beatles in Russia.
I often think about the irony of that. So I thought that the learning Russian was interesting enough, but wasn't going anywhere, and it served me well.
And then that didn't last long because you became a filmmaker.
That's right. Yeah,
and you filmed the Beatles in 1962 in the Liverpool Cavern Club. That's before they were famous.
Yeah, it's the first ever film. In fact, it's the only film of them in the Cavern Club, which was a complete accident. I was just a rookie TV director at the Manchester commercial company. They wanted something, new things going on in our region. Somebody told me there were these kids. They hadn't recorded yet, but they were doing something. Why didn't I go and talk to Mr. Epstein? So I went and did
that. So this is when Ringo was already in the band.
It was his first gig. And I was surrounded by people in the crowd saying, "We want Pete, we want Pete," when we were doing that. And we couldn't even leave the cavern because there were a lot of people waiting to beat us up because we'd filmed without Pete.
Now, what was your impression of the group?
Well, I was a big jazz fan, not a rock and roll fan. But when Brian took me down into the club, I was literally blown away. Absolutely extraordinary, the impact. The music just came up through my legs into my stomach. And there was something extraordinary about it. It was raucous. It was undisciplined. They were joking and eating and carrying on the stage. But there was such energy in it.
How much of has that footage been used over the years?
I wish I owned it, is all I can say.
Well, you say that the way you discovered that John Lennon had been killed was that you were watching television and you saw your footage?
Exactly that. I woke up in the morning. I happened to be in New York that morning. And I switched on the set and this thing was on. I thought, what the heck is going on? What is that? And then the announcer said that John had been shot dead. I also discovered that all across the Soviet Union, while I was working on various other films, people would talk to me about this little film, this two-minute thing that I filmed, and they knew more about it than I did. How on earth they found out, I just do not know.
But you also have made a documentary about the Beatles in the Soviet Union.
I have.
That was 2009.
That's correct.
And that led you to start thinking about writing it as a book?
That's exactly the way it worked, I think, although I'd been kind of pondering this over. I mean, I filmed from the mid-80s in the Soviet Union, as it then was. And for the next 20 years, I kept gathering these stories and hearing these stories and thought about both the book and the film.
When was the ban against the Beatles finally lifted?
They finally went legitimate in 1990.
This is when Gorbachev was already in power for a while.
Oh, he'd gone. I mean, it's amazing how slow it was for this to happen. Paul recorded a special album just for the Soviet market in 1987 called Back in the USSR. And that became a very hot property in the West because it was only released in Russia. But a compilation of Beatles songs wasn't released on Melodia, the state record album, until 1990.
It is kind of funny to think of that song because listening to the lyrics, the Beatles really seem to be talking more about the Beach Boys. Wish they could all be California girls than referring to any East-West politics.
That's right. It's a comic, affectionate take on a Beach Boys song. Actually, most Beatles films songs are bereft of overt political messages, apart from some of John's. So that wasn't the thing that got through. It was the melody and the spirit.
And when John was killed, was that something that was covered in, was it then still the Soviet Union?
Yeah, it was 1980 when John was killed. Yeah, it's before Gorbachev. Yes, it was very much covered. And there were. It's interesting, actually, how the regime, the Kremlin, inverted its line on Lenin instantly from being an evil, rock and roll, seditious propagandist. He became a hawk for truth, fighting the Vietnam War, a peacenik, and they repositioned him almost overnight.
Despite the fact that they maintained the ban against the Beatles.
Exactly, so.
Interestingly, you describe Gorbachev as Russia's first rock and roll president, yes. But the ban continued throughout his presidency.
It did. And indeed, he early on in his presidency, he spoke out very strongly against rock and roll in all its manifestations. It was not an immediate patsy regime for rock and roll.
Well, they always described it as a symbol of Western decadence. And I can even see some rock groups being seen that way.
Totally.
But the Beatles were kind of like a pretty clean, well-kept group.
They were.
Kempt.
Yes, interestingly, the head of culture in the 1970s sent a guy to watch a Stones concert in Warsaw with the faint idea they might allow them to come to Moscow. This was a riot. They tore up the theater, and so the word went out, never in our country.
Well, the Beatles were popular. Everybody wanted to wear jeans. How much significance do we give to all of that in bringing down the Soviet Union?
Well, I think the impact of culture in promoting change in that part of the world can't be overemphasized. Remember, until during the entire communist period, there was no easy way to express any kind of dissent or opposition. And over years, popular culture and particularly music was a way of expressing your dissent. There's a great bard singer called Vladimir Vysotsky who was a pivotal figure about that. He was never able to formally even record, but the whole country knew about him and adored him.
Today, is pop music in Russia mostly Western sounding?
No, I think they have their own vital post-Beatles pop music across a huge spectrum from rock and from punk to Beatles.
And are the Beatles still popular?
Huge. I stood in a room watching a Lenin's birthday party in Leningrad with a 10-year-old standing next to me singing every word and his granddad doing the same.
Leslie Woodhead's documentaries have won many awards in the United States, UK, and around the world. He's the author of two previous books, My Life as a Spy and A Box Full of Spirits. His latest, How the Beatles Rocked the Kremlin, The Untold Story of a Noisy Revolution. It's published by Bloomsbury. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you so much. All right. All right.